simmer down.
I know you're all excited.
Kaz, we good on the video? All right. So I would like to just start off by thanking everyone. I'm not going to use this. Start off by thanking everyone for coming out tonight. I know it's kind of a crazy week of events leading up to the Left Forum Conference this weekend over at Cooper Union. So really appreciate everyone taking the time on a busy Thursday to come join us tonight. My name is Max. I am the development coordinator here at the Breck Forum. And tonight's event, officially titled Prospects for a More Coherent Left, is part of an ongoing series that we're doing this year at the Breck Forum called 1968 Revisited. Basically, a series of events around the 40th anniversary of 1968, but not so much dwelling on the nostalgia of the moment, but really trying to use the anniversary as a way to talk about its relevancy for movements today, lessons learned, and kind of, you know, ways to move forward. So I'm going to actually, we're starting a little bit late tonight, so I'm going to cut my opening remarks a little bit short. Just to say that tonight's event was the product of a lot of things, but I think for me, one of the things that was really clear coming out of the U.S. Social Forum this summer in Atlanta was how popular the conversations there were around revolutionary strategy and left movement building. I think it's fair to say that probably three of the most well-attended sessions at the Social Forum, and maybe can I just get a real quick show of hands, who here in the room went down to Atlanta for the Social Forum this summer? Okay. Yeah, it was kind of a big deal. So three of the most well-attended events down at the Social Forum were, the first was Building Revolutionary Strategy and Organization in the 21st Century. Another one was Another Politics is Possible. And the third one was, and I added this, it kind of fits in, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded. And that was a conversation around the role of the nonprofit industrial complex. And I add that in because I think at its heart, those conversations are really also just about organization and, you know, structure and how to build a left organization on the national level. So with that, I'm glad that we are continuing this discussion with so many amazing activists in the room looking around. Really nice to have all of you here at the Breck Forum. And I'll do one little quick pitch for the Breck Forum. Most of you guys already know, but the Breck Forum is a movement space that needs your help all the time. You know, sometimes, you know, the saying, you don't know what you got till it's gone. And, you know, we need to just, like, be clear around the need for these spaces and be clear around the need for supporting spaces like this. Because there's a lot more of these conversations that we need to be having with each other, and look forward on behalf of the Breck to hosting some of those discussions, hopefully with you guys. So I'm going to introduce the panelists very briefly, starting on my right, Max number two, as we call him, Max Elbaum. And it's a I didn't think that was going to get a laugh, but it's not bad. And I'm just going to read their bios because it's been a long week for me, so I'm a little alright, so Max was part of the radical generation of 1968 that in various ways tried to build and rebuild a coherent and durable left out of the large-scale ferment and broad radicalization of the 1960s. Max offered a history and evaluation of one strand within that effort, the new communist movement, in his book, Revolution in the Air. And for folks who haven't seen it yet, the paperback version came out in 2006 with a new introduction, and urge folks to check that out. Next to the right, R.J. McConney currently works as a nanny and is a volunteer organizer with, I'm going to say it in English because my Spanish is so bad, Regeneration Childcare NYC and the Men's Collaborative Generation 5. RJ is an international adherent to the Zapatista Sixth Declaration and a participant in the Another Politics Possible study group. He writes weekly about Zapatista-inspired rebellion on Turtle Island and throughout the galaxy at zapagringo.com. To the right of him, Ijen Poe, who has been organizing immigrant women workers in New York City since 1996. Before that, she was involved in student organizing for ethnic studies and domestic violence, advocacy in the Asian immigrant community. And she's a member of another study group, the New York City Study Group on Left Organization and Movement Building, which has spent the last year and a half studying the role that left organizations play in movement building. And finally, last but not least, Autumn Brown, who's a founding member of the Rock Dove Collective, NYC-based Radical Community Health Exchange, and serves as president of the board of directors of the Fertility Awareness Center. Autumn, among other things, teaches facilitation and consensus decision-making to community organizers and educators. Join me in just thanking the panel. Thank you. And Max is gonna... Yeah, and so, okay, so a general note about the format. Max is gonna kick it off with a bit of the 68-2008 kind of framework. And then we're gonna go around and each of the panelists is gonna kind of present some opening remarks around the question of the title of the event. And then we're gonna kind of break it down into kind of an inter-panel dialogue, and I'm gonna do my best to try to tease out some relevant questions and get some discussion going for about half hour, and then we're going to open it up to the group. So, Max. I think so.
Okay. Okay, thanks. It's going to be extremely difficult to build a coherent left in this period. Despite all the excellent work and political projects that are underway by my co-panelists, not least, we have to take a good hard look and realize we are starting collectively as a left from a deep hole. The other political tendencies in U.S. political life, from conservatism, the right wing, over to what seems to be a re-energized liberalism, all have much more clout than we do. But it's not only a question of clout. In the last little while, they've been able to move with more unity and focus and have been better able to capture popular discontent than we have. So there's no point going into this project with anything but our eyes open about how difficult it's going to be. At the same time, I would argue that the prospects for making some headway on this, for making a leap, there is the potential for them to be better in the next few years than at any time since 40 years ago, when my generation, the generation of 1968, tried to build a coherent left off the tremendous ferment of the 1960s. And I think there's two main reasons why those prospects have the potential to be excellent for us making a breakthrough in the next while. The first one is what's going on out there in the country. Things that we have very little control over, they're happening outside of us. And that has to do with the prospects for the right-wing coalition that came to power under the banner of Reaganism, and most of the world is called neoliberalism, came to power in the late 70s, largely as an attack on all the gains of the 1960s and even the gains of the 1930s. There's a lot of evidence that that coalition's hold on power and its coherence is breaking up. That coalition has overplayed its hand, particularly in Iraq and the Middle East, but also with its disastrous policies around Katrina, its bashing of immigrants, a whole bunch of other ways has overplayed its hand. And that coalition is fracturing. And on the other side of the ledger, we can see out there in the society a tremendous hunger to repudiate the Bush years and all those disasters that it has brought. And it's taking place especially in some of the most important constituencies, the African-American community, and among young people. Now, right now, that's captured and expressed most in Barack Obama's presidential campaign. Now, everyone in this room, I'm sure, has a critique of the campaign, of where that consciousness is at, that's using that campaign as a vessel, and of the program that's capturing that discontent. But even with that critique, we have to look at how important it is that such large sectors of the population, only 7 years after 9/11, want to repudiate the Bush years and have that whole other energy and are particularly infused with a sense of hope, optimism, and possibility. The second reason is the one that Max One alluded to, which is there is a new generation now coming to the fore politically that has now acquired 10, 15 years of experience. I know different people got on the train at different times, some in the first Gulf War, some in the struggles of the 90s, some in Seattle, the Seattle World Trade Organization protests, some after 9/11. But as a collectivity, as a generation, the leading edge of that generation now has 10, 15 years of political experience, and just as we were in the late 60s, has come to an appreciation of the limits of the existing forms and the existing level of operation and wants to make a leap. You put those two things together, what's happening out there in the country, and a new generation of radicals coming to the fore, engaging this question of building a more coherent left, the prospect for building a left that will be dynamic, influential, relevant, and more coherent are better than they've been at any time since the late 60s. I want to use most of my time to talk a little bit about what were the conditions that my generation that tried to do this engaged with, what some of the pluses and minuses were, and a little bit then about what that looks like, what light that sheds on our situation today. Now, I want to start out by saying my generation failed. We wouldn't be having a conversation about building or rebuilding a coherent left if we had succeeded. We'd all be in the same coherent life. So this is not do what we did. But we did get some distance, and there is much to learn from our successes and our failures. And I want to talk a little bit about some of that. First point, when we came to the same place that all those workshops at the U.S. Social Forum were at, how to make this leap, we're talking about the late 60s now, we were coming off a period of advance. 15 years of political advance, particularly off the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, and we had seen victories. And not only were the progressive movements winning victories, we felt our own individual actions had contributed to those victories. I mean, I'm old enough to remember legal segregation, people sitting in at lunch counters. You really felt that what you did made a difference. Tremendous sense of empowerment and hope, which is a tremendous asset. You cannot build a dynamic current on failure. It has to do with hope, expectation, possibility, and people feeling empowered. And our generation by the late 60s was blessed. That was a gift to us, particularly from the civil rights movement. Second point. Flowing right from the first. The absolute centrality of the movements of communities of color, but in particular in that time, the Black Freedom Movement, driving force, progressive change, and how that shaped our politics. Not simply the question of the communities of color being the most impacted, but also being an empowered force driving progressive change. And viewing those communities, again, the Black Freedom Movement in particular at that period, as a source of strength, inspiration, and positive forward motion, not as a sense of a community impacted by oppression principally, although obviously that resistance was a response to the special oppression of African Americans. That shakes up politics. That moves politics. It's a tremendous driving force. It's a constant threat in U.S. history. From Amazing Grace to the Battle Hymn of the Republic to We Shall Overcome, that threat of U.S. history is right there at the center. Third point, by the time we got to examining the kinds of questions and of theory, ideology, and organization that a lot are on people's minds now, there had already been a political sorting out process because we had the benefit of participating in sustained large-scale social movements on a nationwide level. Again, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, that brought all social forces into play. So you, where did you stand with those social forces? And when it came time to build a left, when we started to confront are my, you know, whatever ism and what's my ideology and what kind of organization, you are already doing that with whole networks of people that you had found yourself on the same side with in a whole range of struggles. Where did you stand on the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge? Where did you stand in relation to defense of the Black Panther Party? Where did you stand in relationship to the Vietnamese liberation struggle? Where did you stand in relationship to the society's attitude toward Black nationalism? There are a whole range of questions that you interacted with, not just in theory or in books, but out there in coalitions where everybody from right to left was present. That was a tremendous force, meaning that when we got to questions of organization and ideology, there was already a lot of politics infused in that. And the last point is that the left grew in tandem with a much broader popular movement of very diverse character. And those forces on the left that tried to separate themselves out or allowed themselves to be separated from being in that tandem were marginalized. In the sections of the left that grew, what was in that interaction with those large-scale popular movements. Two other points, more on the level then of what we, how we handled all this. We made a revolutionary turn, and that was right. But we assessed what the prospects were politically, what was the political moment, what was on the immediate historical agenda, and we made a terrible blunder. Across the board, the late 60s left anticipated further motion to the left and a society rapidly moving to the left with all kinds of new possibilities for revolutionary development, revolutionary organization, revolutionary influence. It's not a surprise. We generalized from our experience. We had seen change so rapid in the 1960s, we thought it was just going to continue. You know, when you're young and you're passionate and you've seen those changes, well, you think that's the way it is, that's the way it's going to be. But we were wrong. And we did not anticipate the ebb in the popular movement to be as deep as it was. I mean, we weren't completely naive. We figured there'd be some kind of ebb, but we didn't realize how deep it was, and we didn't see the right coming the way that it came at us. And this is across the board. It doesn't matter what ideology you were. This afflicted the entire left. We misassessed the historical moment, and that afflicted our organizations, our consciousness of how we thought, how we lived, the kind of lifestyles we lived, as well as the politics and the strategies that we did. So we were way off. The last point is we also adopted the view, which was dominant in the international left at the time, that a victory for one trend on the left came at the expense of other trends on the left. And everybody else on the left was a rival. So it was win-lose. And that accounts for a lot of the sectarian battles that went on that you can, you know, people have their stories about. Now, there were real differences, and you have to struggle out differences. You know, one big happy family doesn't work either, suppressing real political differences. But the idea that anyone who you disagree with is a rival, that really does not work. And that's one of the worst things that has meant so many people from my generation, when they talk about that period, they will tell you stories of how, you know, terrible it was and what it meant for their lives and their relationships with other people and so on. And no one wants to go back to that. So let me end with a few reflections about today to try to situate what some of those things might mean for today. First point, we are not coming off a period of 15 years of advance. Okay, we are coming off a period of one defeat after another. 25, 30 years of Reaganism. It doesn't mean nothing was won in that time. Certainly there were some victories, but overall, it's a defensive period, and particularly the constituencies that are the base for progressive politics, the communities of color, the labor movement, women, youth, poor people have taken a tremendous hit. And those communities are suffering from that. And that, in turn, affects the mentality of the left. We may be at a turning point. It may be that the right will be defeated in the 2008 elections, and it will be one of those elections that people look back on that mark an end of one block in the ruling class ruling and a different social constellation coming to the fore. People have compared it to Kennedy in 1960 or Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. But for us, it's at best like the late 50s or early 60s. It's not 1968. And what does that mean about where we are and our mentality? And there's two parts of that. One, at best, we're entering a reformist period. But a reformist period looks damn good compared to what we've been through the last 7 years. So how to calibrate that change and what it might mean? Extremely important. Second, communities of color, if anything, are more central to the U.S. political life than they were in the 60s because of the changing demographics. It's a qualitative change from those of us who became political in the early 60s, largely because of the 1965 immigration reform, the end of racial quotas. The whole demographic of the country has changed. People of color are more central to the working class and oppressed peoples than they were even in the 1960s. But the social motion in those communities reflects this problem of all the defeats of the last 30 years. So we've seen a couple of instances that we really need to think about and analyze. One was the immigrant rights upsurge in 2006. It has not been sustained at that level, but we caught a glimpse of what the power of that community is and what that means for U.S. politics when that sector mobilizes. The other is the role of the African-American community in the Obama campaign. The Obama campaign did not start out like the Jesse Jackson campaign as based in the African-American community. But as the campaign has evolved, the African-American community has proven to be the main social force behind Obama's campaign in terms of the popular level. I'm not talking about all the corporate advisors and the big money and all that, which is certainly calling the shots. So when you get 90% of the African-American vote in Mississippi, that means something, especially when you're running against Hillary Clinton, who was identified with the person, if anyone remembers the 90s, called the first black president in the United States. So what does that mean that it's taking that form, and how do we relate to it? It's another central political question. And in those two experiences, the African-American community and the immigrant communities anchored by the Latino sectors of the immigrant communities. Okay, third point, I'm going to move right along here. The political sorting out that our generation went through has not yet been able to happen on the same level. It's not because the activists are any less talented or smarter. You're much more talented. You have a much more holistic view than we did. There's a tremendous amount of savvy that you all have learned from your experiences and maybe some of it from our generation. But there haven't been those same kind of nationwide political movements with all social forces that you could engage with. So that political sorting out is not all that developed. So one of the implications of that is I find in a lot of conversations people use the same words but mean completely different things. Because there aren't concrete reference points that you can point to. This means when we say petty bourgeois radicalism. Well, is there something in the world there? We had something to point to. This is what petty bourgeois radicalism looks like. This is what black nationalism looks like on a nationwide scale. Those things look completely different to people in different parts of the country. So it's even hard to conduct that conversation and know who your allies are. You have these intense weekend retreats with people. You go away, but it doesn't necessarily mean you know where y'all stand. Now, that's not something that can be solved intellectually. That's a question of what happens out there in the world in your relationship to it. 1 minute? Great. And you haven't had the chance, for the same reasons, to grow in tandem with the broad popular movement, because the broad popular movement has been so much on the defensive, especially since 9/11. If that's changing, though, this is the opportunity. This is the moment. Everybody is trying to figure out what the political landscape is going to look like after November 2008 and who is going to be ready to move. And those kinds of questions, because people sense a shift in the political climate and what constellation of forces might be running the country. Last two things then, flowing from the last ones. The historical moment. You know, I'm a broken record on this, so, you know, that's me. But grasping where we are at the moment and making that a focus of sustained discussion and debate, putting it at the middle of our efforts, I think is really important. Because that frames what your alliances are, what your tactics are, your relation to the broad mass, particularly the key constituencies, the working class, communities of color, specially oppressed groups. It lays the foundation also for figuring out what questions do you need to unite around and which ones are for a great conversation over beer after the forum. But, you know, hey, let's not divide over this. Autumn and I were talking about this beforehand. You need a sense of, at any given time in the left, there's a million questions. Some of them really make a difference on where you're going to go. You're not going to build an anti-war movement if you think Iran is the main danger to Iraq right now. You know what I'm saying? So if somebody thinks that, well, you're going to have a difference of opinion and you'll see them later. But what you think of happened in 1928 between Stalin and Trotsky might not be the central question of who's on what team here. So getting a sense of proportion about that is important. And that sense of proportion is principally determined by the historical moment and where the masses are at and where the struggles are on the agenda. They're not determined by the ideological history of the left. However important, I mean, I can stay up all night arguing with anybody, but my two cents about that stuff don't mean shit. Where is the political motion in this country where we are stuck in the belly of the beast? And the last thing, I know no one here wants to go back to that sectarian stuff, and one of the most delightful things about interacting with your generation for me is there really is. I mean, you can feel the love between people who have a lot of differences, and it's a true delight. You face possibly the opposite problem, which is there's a reluctance to disagree, go our different ways, and hopefully one trend's maturation pulls up other trends, as opposed to it's a knockdown, drag-out fight.
I agree.
Any questions?
So I think that everything that Max just put out is actually really, really helpful. And he did the important work of actually talking about an assessment of what we're up against, which I think is where we need to begin this conversation. And where we started as the New York City study group that has many names depending on who you ask, but the study group that I've been a part of, I think originated out of an assessment of what we're up against and a sense of urgency around the questions that Max laid out in terms of how do we understand the opportunities and the challenges before us, and how do we know what is the next move? And how do we know that what we're doing on the ground right now is going to yield a stronger, more revolutionary, mass popular movement 10 years from now? You know, I think a lot of us had been doing organizing for, as Max said, about 15, 10, maybe 8, 7 years and had these questions. You know, are we just spinning our wheels? Is this going to yield a broader, more rooted, more stronger and strategic movement 10 years from now and fundamentally more revolutionary? We don't know. And so we had all these questions, and I think that that was the intention in terms of why we started a study process here in New York about a year and a half ago, maybe something like that. And I think what we started, the question that we started with was, what is the role of left organizations? And I think that in building the movement, because we were clear that what's really needed is actually a stronger, broader, more rooted and dynamic mass popular movement. That fundamentally, that's what we need fundamentally a left needs to be a part of and integrated with a movement, and that it's not a thing that can be even conceived of separate and apart from a movement. And that there has historically been a role that left organizations have played in building and strengthening movements, and trying to understand that and understanding what's needed for today. And I think we studied a lot of historical examples, we studied international examples, and I think that what we came to was that whatever we develop needs to be based on the time, place, and conditions of today, which are fundamentally different. Our context here in the belly of the beast, here in the global city of New York, needs to be our context, and whatever our strategy is needs to be rooted in that context, which is fundamentally different from the historical examples that we were studying, and the international examples that we were looking at. That said, there was a lot that we could learn and draw from, and a lot that we found helpful in looking at those examples. And I'll just sort of put out some of the things that we kind of came to at the end of this round of the study, and then we can kind of go into the more discussion aspect of it, because we're just doing quick hits for the first round. So some of the stuff that we came to was that there are some strategic priorities for the left right now. And we had four. We said that what we need is fundamentally to support mass organizing. We need to support grassroots, base building, organizing in communities of color, in the working class. And that's fundamentally critical, that it begins there. And that we also need to develop a working revolutionary theory and strategy that is based on and emerges from our current time, place, and conditions. That we need to innovate and build upon and tweak and shift and rethink strategies, revolutionary strategy and theory, based on our own time, place, and conditions today. And that we need revolutionary leadership development. We need leadership development that really supports, really builds the capacity of folks in the movement to lead, to organize, to raise consciousness, to run and wage campaigns that improve the living conditions of the working class in a way that builds the broader movement in a more revolutionary direction. And so that piece around training, political training, capacity building, so that we actually have the capacity to really organize, to work together, to be strategic, think strategically, that is a really important piece of what we need in going into the future. And we also said that we need to build left unity. And for us, that is both about unifying existing left organizations, revolutionary organizations, parties, right? It's about that, but it's also about unifying the social movement left, or the folks who are working inside social justice organizations, grassroots organizations, base building organizations, individuals and organizations who are left, who are revolutionary identified, who are trying to figure it out, trying to figure out these long-term movement building questions, that they're part of the process of unifying and strengthening the left. And that unity, we need to figure out a fundamental thing that we reflected on was that given the amount of unity that we actually have with the amount of people out there, that we're somehow not able to actually win things that should be won. Like there are struggles that we're engaged in as left folks, that that we have enough agreement around to actually make a difference in the lives of working class people and in the lives of oppressed communities. And because of our disunity, we're not able to actually coordinate strategically. And that is something that we feel like is fundamentally something that we need to work on. So we talked a lot about this concept of functional unity. Even if we don't agree ideologically on every question, that we have enough political unity to actually be able to get some really important things done in the interests of our communities and in the interests of the working class. For example, ending the war in Iraq. You know, for the amount of people who are against the war in Iraq and the amount of left leadership that exists out there, we should be able to do certainly more than we've been able to do. And so how do we get to a different place? How do we develop a practice of working together in the interests of our communities and in the interests of the working class as a whole? So just stop there.
And just as a super quick plug on that last point, for anyone who's going to be awake at 10 a.m. on Sunday, after what will be the party of the year on Saturday night right here at the Breck Forum, for those of you who are going to be awake, me and Max are going to be part of a larger panel on strategies around anti-war organizing over at Cooper Union as part of the Left Forum. So please show up. I feel like it's going to be like five or six of us in that room. So. RJ.
Hi, everyone. I really agree with this point that we have a hard time knowing what each other means because we don't have those reference points where we can say, okay, this word means this, this means this. We can really understand each other. And so I feel like the things that we say in our little five-minute intros are going to need to, like, really be sussed out. And, you know, we probably won't get through it tonight. But I'm really excited that this is happening. I'm also part of a study group in New York City called Another Politics is Possible, although I'm not going to be able to speak to it in the same way that iGen did, because we're still working out kind of what would be an initial statement, what is kind of an initial thing we'd like to put out about the thinking that we're developing. So the thinking I'm going to share tonight, some of it's definitely informed by that, but I can't really say that this is coming from that place. So the thinking is also informed by, I would say I come from the generation of 94. So, so a lot of my way of understanding the world was informed by the Zapatista perspective and from communiques and from sort of starting to really understand the way that power is organized today through that. And then it's also informed by my own experience as a campus organizer, as a labor organizer, as a paid community organizer, as an unpaid community organizer over the last 10 years. And so it's going to be coming from kind of those places. I think that there are some fruitful approaches that we can take to build a more coherent radical left in the next 2 to 5 years. I think that there are some ripe conditions that Max pointed out, and I'm going to maybe give my own spin on it, which is that although the Bush administration has succeeded in transferring massive amounts of public wealth into the private hands of the corporate elites that are aligned with them, the project has failed in the sense that they haven't created an alternative sort of democracy in the Middle East, the model that they hoped to create with Iraq, and also they haven't been able to contain Iran, which I think was another hope. So this project that comes out of the war on terror has really failed. And I think that there was a shift after 9/11 with the war on terror where we started to refocus on U.S. imperialism. And I think that was really necessary. But I think if we really look at things today, U.S. power is waning globally. And I think that if you want to look at global power and global capital and how it's organized, it really limits us in terms of our analysis and in terms of our strategy if we still focus on U.S. imperialism and think that that is really sort of the key linchpin to global power and global capital. When really, in 2008, it's organized through a series of strong nation states through supranational corporations, through supranational organizations, NAFTA, the upcoming Security and Prosperity Partnership that would be the sort of war on terrorism version of NAFTA for Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, the G8, and also many international NGOs form what is today really the community of power that we know of in terms of power over, right? So these are the people that are keeping systems of oppression in place. And I think the defeat of the Bush administration of their plan really allows us to refocus on that broader sort of conception of how power is organized today. And that has everything to do with then what do we do about that? I think it still makes sense, even though I'm sort of talking about it on a global scale and talking about these different nation states and all that, I think it still makes sense to organize at the national level because there are certain historical and cultural roots that still matter and that we still have to respond to. And at the same time, more and more, you're finding that a member of the U.S. working class is sending remittances to another country. A member of the U.S. working class is working at a call center in India. These are things that we have to take into account. You know what? Our conception of the U.S. working class is going to inherently become transnational. So even if we start to build a national movement, we're going to find very quickly that we're actually building a transnational movement. I would also like to point out that the real estate, the land, the territory in Manhattan is being bought up by European capital right now. So again, you know, an anti-gentrification battle in New York City isn't necessarily against U.S. imperialism or sort of internal colonization by U.S. elites, but there's global forces at work, and we really need to think strategically about how to go after them. So all that having been said, for those of us that seek not just a better distribution of wealth under capitalism, but seek to do away with capitalism and all the systems of oppression with which it intersects, white supremacy, patriarchy, heterosexism, ableism, to name a few. I think that continuing to build and improve on the U.S. social forum process is really our best bet in the next 2 to 5 years in terms of building a coherent radical left in the United States. The U.S. social forum is incredibly successful in establishing a left pole that was much stronger than even the World Social Forum process, which is kind of amazing if you think about it in terms of the United States in the context of the globe. And I think there are also some improvements, some challenges, some things that we can build on from the first experience. A coherent radical left in the United States, as everyone said, really needs to be built by, or at least in the short term, useful and accessible to people and communities most targeted by these systems of oppression. The U.S. Social Forum got off to a very good start with that. There were so many different organizations around the country that took that commitment to heart. And I think we need to keep moving that as we move forward in that process of creating some sort of national networking process. And really the reason I think the Social Forum is so important is because before we can do anything else, we need to open up a space where we can meet each other, and not just sort of listen to each other, but where we can meet each other and start to respect each other, you know, and start to build some social relations. And that really needs to happen before we can move on, before we can even start to figure out, well, what does this word mean and what does that word mean? Because I also feel like we're in a moment that it's that we're not necessarily going to have to totally split up into camps. I don't think we're going to eventually have to choose an ism. Because there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think partially because we choose isms based on our own particular histories. So you choose an ism based on where you come from. Each of us is a historical subject. And so we come from different stories. We come from different histories. And there are going to be disagreements and there are going to be all these things, but a lot of times we're raising different banners, but we want to build the same thing. What one group calls a dictatorship of the proletariat might mean people power to another group. And we got to get comfortable with that. You know, I don't mean to say that it's all semantics and that, but I think that a lot of us share the same commitments, but we come from different traditions. And to the extent that we can figure out what's what, you know, we're going to be moving forward. One thing that I think the forum did not succeed a lot in was sort of prefiguring the world we want to create, whether we want to call that socialist world, whether we just want to call it another world, a better world. You know, we were still staying in the corporate hotels and we were still doing a lot of things that didn't really give us a picture of what we're fighting for. And it's understandable given the limitations the organizers were under. So it's not a critique of the organizing. It's more of like, what can we do? Like, how far can we go? And so this also gives us the opportunity to engage with a lot of people whose day-to-day work or whose sort of orientation is less focused on in the realm of ideas, and it's more focused in the realm of a certain practice. So we can bring in people that do really creative stuff around building networks, that do really creative stuff around conflict resolution, that do really creative stuff around housing. Like, how can we set up sort of our own networks in this way? You know, we can start to engage people that have more technical skills, which is another thing that I think the social forum already is like allowing us to do. You see, there's meetings of like the solidarity economy. There's people trying to set up an economy that's based on solidarity rather than capitalism, even under capitalism. There's the radical healthcare people, media centers, and all this stuff. We got to honor that and build it and recognize that that stuff is also a piece of the work. There's the analysis, and then there's also this piece where we're actually doing it, right? And those feed back into each other. I think we also need to make the U.S. Social Forum in this process sexy or hot or whatever you want to call it, like, which I don't think we did a good job of. I think we need another media strategy that tells a story that like captures people's imagination, hope, change, you know, all that stuff. Because I think in 2 years, if we do it in 2010, people are going to be getting tired of Obama or Hillary or, you know, whatever. But and there's going to be that moment where we need to tap into people's imaginations and say, no, we can keep pushing. So that was my attempt at kind of giving a really specific idea of a way that we could go that would build a more radical, coherent left. Stop there.
Yeah, I agree that by 2010 people will be tired of hope. Definitely. No, seriously. I mean, really. Hi, everyone. How's everyone doing?
Yeah.
Good. Yay. So I want to talk about anarchist strategies. Who here knows a little bit about anarchism? About anarchism, all right. As an anarchist, I cannot represent other anarchists. it's against what anarchism is. But what I can talk about is some strategies that I see practiced in some of the anarchist groups that I work with that I think have implications, have broader implications for the left if they were sort of strategies that were taken up. I want to just build on this idea of skill building in the movement, as opposed to focusing on issues, but focusing more around strategies that are useful across the board, techniques that can be used by everyone, techniques that can engage people who don't necessarily identify as political, because I think that's really where we're going. Just to sort of put myself in context, I would say I'm the 2001 generation. My first day of college was 9/11, and so that was a very politicizing moment for me. I was actually in a class called Empires to Nations, The Birth of the Modern Middle East, when the planes hit the building. Not kidding you. So that's sort of the moment that I came into being, you know, political, and definitely my analysis has evolved from there. But so I guess just to sort of give a little context, some of the things that I'm thinking about as an anarchist in terms of a more coherent left are issue of authentic rhetoric. What is the rhetoric of the left at the current moment, and how do we make it an authentic rhetoric? This issue of mass movement, which I think speaks to the issue of massification, that we live in a massive system. And so I think there's a necessarily there's this desire, there's this tendency towards wanting to do mass organizing. But for anarchists, that's a question. Like, is mass organizing really what's going to get us out of this fix that we're in? Or is it just feeding into a massified system? And with that, I want to talk a little bit about this, the anarchist idea of dual power and some of the projects that I'm involved in that I think kind of represent that a little bit. So on the topic of rhetoric, I just want to say quickly that I think I see in the left this sort of issue that I feel like the left's rhetoric is sort of centered around the left claiming these core values that are represented by systems that don't exist yet. Universal healthcare and direct democracy and, you know, fill in the blank. And I wonder how much more authentic the left's rhetoric could be if we really looked into the legacy of the left and claimed our own radical history as a way of talking about our core values, as opposed to claiming things that people don't see in their daily lives yet. You know what I mean? So I think that that's an issue. And I think that it could even go further than that in terms of, I think we need to speak to our own historical instances of true leftist moments. But I think it could go even deeper into a discussion of where do leftist tendencies exist in our culture? I just want to mention two writers at this point that I think are really interesting in terms of this. And one is David Graeber, who I think, you know, he does a lot of writing about anarchist anthropologies, which don't, you know, seek to defend the sort of status quo identification of how culture comes into being, but rather sort of identify a diversity of how we have constructed ourselves socially over the course of entire human history that gives us some sense of how we might construct ourselves. It's a question. We don't have to live in this system. And so I think if our rhetoric can sort of speak more to that, it might be stronger. So he's one writer. I think everyone should read some of David Graeber. And I think everyone should then, after that, read Octavia Butler, who's an anarchist science fiction writer who speaks to sort of the next level of that kind of stuff. So write it down, Octavia Butler. In terms of this whole issue of massification, you know, I don't think it's not really arguable. We live in a system that the size begets neglect, theft of resources, hoarding of resources, deflection of community concerns onto this immovable bureaucracy, and then just deeper and deeper alienation of individuals, of families, of communities. And it's just big enough that our movements can be undermined by media deceiving us into this idea of a global community. You know, that's how big the system is, which I think is really interesting. And so I think whether a mass movement is something that could truly ever be really effective is definitely a question. Whether it's a good idea is a question. For anarchists, we have this sort of idea that we're constantly evolving of dual power, which asserts that alongside this system and inside this system, we build alternative systems, alternative economies, alternative systems of care, alternative systems of accessing food, fill in the blank, to try to address some of these issues that are created by the massive system. In terms of, you know, the question on the description of today's panel, you know, talked about nonprofits and whether nonprofits really serve us. And, you know, from my perspective, having worked in nonprofits and working in one now, grateful, they pay me. It's nice to be able to eat. So I don't hate on nonprofits. But I do think that nonprofits are a product of capitalism. They make sense from the perspective, I mean, working through nonprofits makes sense from the perspective of reform, not from the perspective of transform or transformation. You know, they depended on the capitalist system for resources. And if you've ever worked in a nonprofit, you know how impossible, nearly impossible it is to have any kind of consistent, effective program because you're constantly competing for grant funding and foundation funding. And what your program looks like is totally, it's at the behest of what the funders are wanting to fund. And you have to shift the language. And,